The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, and 24/7 support. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello, welcome back to Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha.
So my reading of the evidence in depression, for example, is that actually antidepressants don't really have any clinically significant or useful effects in people with depression.
Dr. Joanna Moncrief tells us why she thinks we've been treating psychiatric disorders all wrong. The drugs, she says, probably don't work. And we cast a critical eye across this week's big science news, including ever more mystery around dark matter, and a new virus found in bats that links the mammals more closely to the SARS outbreak of 2002. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Let's kick off with some news this week. With us is the Observer's science team. All of you are here. Robin, always good to have you here.
Thank you. Great to be back.
Good morning. Good morning to you too. And Nicola Davis is here also. This is you had your first episode last week and you were so excited that you came back.
Yep, survived and back again.
Fantastic. Let's go through this week's science news and we'll also talk about next month's Observer Science Tech Monthly magazine. Well, I'm calling it Science Tech Monthly. I know that's not the real name, but we all think of it that way, don't we?
That's what it is.
We'll come to that towards the end. Robin, let's start with dark matter. There's been an interesting result announced this last week on the hunt for dark matter. So just before we get to that result, tell us what dark matter is.
Right, dark matter is a problem for physicists because we conclude that it must be there because observations of galaxies rotating show that they're rotating far too quickly for their own observable mass. If there wasn't extra mass in these galaxies, they would spin apart. So we conclude there must be something, some other form of mass that we cannot see in the universe. All sorts of candidates have been kicked out the window, burnt out suns, rogue planets, you name it. And we are left with one thing, they're called WIMPs, weak interacting massive particles, that we conclude as permeating the universe and clumping round our galaxies and keeping them nice and heavy and giving them a central body. The trouble is we can't see the things, and so we're trying really, really hard to do it. And what the one way you can do it is, well, there are several ways to try, but the most promising method is to bury your detectors deep underground so that they are not battered by all sorts of other forms of mostly muons battering us from outer space and giving you spurious signals in your detectors. And that is what we've got, several of these all around the world. And we've had results back from the biggest and probably the most promising of these that's looked at several kind of range of categories of particles and reported they found absolutely nothing.
Yeah, this is the Lux detector in South Dakota. And as you said, there's many, many of them around the world and they're down these mines because these weakly interacting massive particles can travel through almost anything. So the best chances of mopping up everything else and leaving the WIMPs, as it were, are to have them down mines. The Lux detector found absolutely nothing. This is disturbing.
It is. I mean, but again, I suppose...
Because we've had hints before.
Well, they've had hints before and they've not found them. But then if you look to what happened at CERN 2 or 3 years ago, we found absolutely no sign of Higgs. And then, you know, they looked at promising places, no sign of it. And then suddenly, you know where not to look. So you look somewhere else and then you have the chance of seeing it. And that's really what they're doing. They're eradicating certain sizes of particles and that gives them a chance to look elsewhere. It's a process of elimination.
Tell us what's so special about Lux, though. What's the sort of setup?
Well, the Lux is like several other detectors. I visited the one in Italy at Gran Sasso. Basically, it's a series of Russian dolls. You think of it that way. You've got a big aluminium sphere and then you put it down this mine and inside it you put water, thousands of litres of water, and that takes out the last spurious muon signals that are coming through. Then you put it in, you've got inside that, you've got another container that hopefully gets rid of the last few of those muons. And then you've got you've got xenon inside that. And when a WIMP hits a xenon nucleus dead on, it should give a scintilla of light, and you should be able to detect that. And that's what they have not done yet.
And the other detectors that we're talking about, for example, the cryogenic dark matter search in another mine in America, actually, that's seen candidates before.
Yes.
And if those things were really dark matter particles, then Lux should have seen thousands of the same examples.
About 1,500. Squid.
So that means that the previous results were, well, they weren't dark matter.
Exactly.
Yeah, which is interesting. I mean, it's making it harder to find.
We should be clear about why dark matter is important, by the way, because we would not exist if it was not for dark matter. Dark matter is what gave the universe its clumpiness. It's about four-fifths of the universe mass is made up of this stuff. Galaxies would not have formed out the primordial dust after the Big Bang if it had not been for dark matter. And from those galaxies, you get stars and you get planets and you get us. So we're here because of this stuff. So it's really nice to know what it's going to be like.
I'm fairly sure that the dark matter gives my head clumpiness in the mornings too. It needs to dissipate.
Underneath that perfectly coiffured head,
It's mostly dark matter. Okay. How does it not fly off, what do you think, when I move around so fast? Nicola, this is essentially a negative result. You wonder what's the point of telling everyone so loudly, because it was quite widely trailed, this.
Well, I think what's important is the fact that, you know, this is how science works. You know, you have these experiments which showed that perhaps they had found some candidates for dark matter. It looked very promising. Now we have these results from Lux which show that those maybe aren't the right things to be looking at. And this is how science progresses. You know, it doesn't happen with one person suddenly finding one result that everybody else confirms. It's a question of sort of, you know, backwards and forwards, and we think we found something, oh no, we haven't. And this is a perfect example of that. So I don't think that, you know, scientists should be depressed that we haven't confirmed the results found at the CMDS experiments and so on. I think this is...
And also, no one knows what dark matter is. I mean, let's be clear about this.
This is the good point. The point about it is we are assuming, we're calling them WIMPs. We're saying because we assume or hope that they weakly interact with the matter that we have here. But there's absolutely no proof that it will. It may be it just never interacts, and we can only infer its existence from the behaviour of galaxies. We may never discover it. There is that prospect.
And the other candidates, well, there are loads of other candidates, and the idea is that all these detectors are set up to test for one or two of these sorts of things. There's no general detector for everything, is there? And I do like the candidates for the next sort of set. If they're not WIMPs, then they're possibly called WISPs, which is weakly interacting slim particles. I have no idea what they are. Yeah. And my favourite, which has always been my favourite, was a particle called the axion, named after a washing powder, because it was invented in the 60s, 70s, whatever, by particle physicists as a way of cleaning up physics. Oh. this is how particles get named.
Grubby experiment. You need axion.
You need axion. You can't accuse physicists of not having, having a good sense of humour. Previous dark matter candidate, so we've got the WIMPs, of course. The previous dark matter candidate was something called the Macho. The massively, what was it called? I can't remember what it's called.
I can't remember. It was either Machos or WIMPs, but
so
the Machos have lost
machos
out.
To WIMPs
Machos probably aren't dark matter. Yeah, we know that now. Machos are something about, they're the compact halo objects, i.e. the things that are in space, which are normal matter, which we can't see, essentially. It's like you're saying dead stars, etc. It's probably not that. It's probably likely to be WIMPs. Could be supersymmetrical particles, but they know.
Oh, that's looking a bit That's
a new theory of physics that goes beyond the standard model, suggests all these new particles, and one of those, the neutralino, could be dark matter. They haven't found those either.
No. I mean,
Tough time for physics.
It's not just detectors down mines that are looking for dark matter. I mean, CERN, the LHC at CERN is also trying to make it.
But wasn't that one of the problems with the supersymmetry that the CERN experiment hasn't shown any evidence?
It is shown none. And the EMS, which is the magneto experiment that's on the space station, is also trying to detect it from, you should see a certain number of positrons from collisions of WIMPs, and they say they see them, but people all say, well, yeah, but it could come another, it could be produced another way, you don't know.
All right.
So the jury's well out, as it were.
It is one of the most exciting, one of the more sort of exciting edges of physics, I would say, because we know it's there, we just don't know what it is. Well, let's move on to some medical science. And again, Nicola, this is a story about publishing data that maybe isn't so flattering to the scientific community, as it were. This is tell us about this. This is about clinical trials.
This is a part of the sort of raging debate that's happening, and it's really sort of shaking up clinical trials, which is that people are more and more pushing for the results of clinical trials to be published, and particularly that negative results or results which show that medicines maybe give side effects or which perhaps sometimes they don't work as you know, as well as you know, drug companies would like to kind of advertise that they do. These are sort of quietly just, you know, sort of tucked under the carpet, and that they're not published and they're not publicised. And this is something which is problematic. You know, people are taking part in these trials. They're often taking part in these trials because they, you know, putting themselves potentially at risk for the greater good, to, you know, to progress drug discovery and to make sure that we know the side effects and we know the problems. So not publishing these results is a big problem. And legislation did come in the States to try to make sure that this results were published. But apparently it seems that about one in three of large clinical trials remains unpublished.
So let's go through this. This is a study published in the British Medical Journal last week, which showed that 29% of clinical trials are unpublished 5 years after they're finished. And of those, something like 80% almost have no results at all available in the public domain.
Exactly.
And 250,000 people involved in those trials, like you said, probably for various reasons, either they're patients or they've volunteered for medical benefit, for the greater good, and their sacrifice essentially is not being used by the community. Why is it important? I mean, look, in the previous example, we talked about physicists publishing the fact they couldn't find anything, and doing it with big fanfare, by the way. And why is it that it's important this happens in medicine?
Well, this is true just across the whole of science. You know, it's not about cherry picking the results that you like and then saying, well, this is the case. It's about being honest and being open and saying, you know, this drug, yes, it does do all these good things, but there are these side effects, or but it's not shown to be effective in this group, this cohort. And it's about making sure that all that information is out there, because with that information out there, then you can develop the drug better. But of course, if you're pouring huge amounts of money into developing a drug, and you know, it takes huge amounts of time and money to get it through the clinical trials and so on and so forth to get it onto the market, you don't really want, you know, in the mind of the drug companies, perhaps you don't want one negative result to get in.
Robin, you can understand, well, at least from a corporate point of view, if you're a big drug company, you spent hundreds of millions of pounds developing a drug. You've done three clinical trials, and two of them are a bit, you know, whiffy, yeah. And the other one is really good. You'd publish the one that's really good.
Yes. The trouble is, of course, that the other two are, you know, as you say, Nicola, may have side effects, and these side effects are hidden.
Is there any suggestion that this is
going on?
And
then you have to withdraw, you know, that drug later on. So, you know, you're losing out on yourself.
Do we know if there's any suggestion that this sort of thing is going on? I mean, you can never sort of predict, you can never infer the intentions of anyone, any companies or anything, but the fact that drugs like Vioxx and others were withdrawn because there were so many problems with them. So Vioxx was a drug for osteoarthritis, I think, which then caused heart problems and had to be withdrawn. It should never have been on the market in the first place.
Yes. I mean, how much is this going on? I think if you were with the drug companies, or if you were a doctor, you would say, we're not getting enough drugs on the marketplace. And that's the problem. How you go about it? Well, you know, capitalism is the only model we've got so far, and it's the big companies are the only people who can afford to make them.
I think one other interesting statistic from this news story is actually that trials funded by industry were more likely not to have published their results. So 32% of trials versus 18% which weren't funded by industry. So I think that it certainly gives you food for thought. I mean, obviously you can't...
Companies also have commercial interests. I mean, if you don't publish a trial, it might be because there's data in there that might be useful to your rivals, right?
That presumably is why they're doing it.
Well, that's what they're saying.
Yes.
Who knows? I mean, unless you see... they will argue, of course, also that the regulators do see all the data, even if it's not published, I believe. Yes.
But this is true across the whole of science. I mean, this is, you know, there's a publication bias across the whole of science of positive results. I mean, as long as your hypothesis is that you're testing in your experiments is, you know, reasonable, there is no reason really why you shouldn't be publishing it if your results are negative.
Yeah.
And, you know, this idea that, you know, you're going to be giving your competitors an edge, I mean, the whole point is to move science forward at the end of the day, and that and to provide the best drugs for you know, your patients.
I reckon there's some sort of shareholders who would say it's to make me as much money as possible.
Well, that's
let's
it.
Be honest.
The difference with it in this case is that lots of money is at stake.
Although the problem actually, Nicola, you're talking about in terms of the larger problem in science, I mean, especially in some areas like psychology, there's been a lot of debate in the last couple of years about experiments which are essentially publishing only the positive results. So you're skewing what's really known. I mean, that there's a much more clear-cut case there that all the results should be published because you want to find the truth about behavior or whatever else. And you're not doing that if you're publishing only the best results, only the sort of most positive ones that are most high impact. But also there's another sort of side to that, which is that sometimes, and many psychologists are acknowledging this and wanting to do things about it, where you start off with one hypothesis, collect data, and then you sort of just publish, and you find something else along the way, which is actually might sound like a normally quite a good thing to do if you're not doing science, but you've got to not do that in scientific stuff. You've got to test a hypothesis in a certain way. You can't just make it up as you go along, right?
Well, there is a problem as well, which is that when it comes to publishing, it takes a lot of time and it can be expensive to publish your work. And also it's about people get very hung up on the impact factor of their work. Now, if you do, say, a chemical reaction and you think it should provide you with an exciting product and it doesn't do that, or it just does something completely different, it's negative, it doesn't provide you with an exciting result, that's not going to get published in a high-impact journal. And for a lot of people, a lot of academics, there is this pressure to have high-impact publications. So why would you spend your time publishing something which is going to end up in an obscure journal somewhere?
I think that's the scientific truth. That yes. Justice, the scientific way.
Yes. No, I mean, no? This is just a, you know, sort of giving that point of view.
They're just in it for themselves, aren't they?
I know. Whereas we journalists, we sweat away here for the nobility of our cause.
And yeah, exactly. Let's move on to a wonderful, an interesting, complex story about a scientist who's done some good things and, well, Robin, tell us about Fritz Haber. You've written about him for The Observer.
Yes, Fritz Haber, German chemist, the man who found a way of synthesizing ammonia. That was a major triumph for technology in the 20th century. Up till that point, fertilizers that the world's growing population needed could only come from essentially from biological processes, mostly bird shit or guano, if you want to call it that. And the world was running out of this stuff. We were dredging it off islands off Peru, that's Pacific Islands. We needed this stuff desperately. And he found a way of turning nitrogen from the air, synthesizing it with steam and other products, and to make artificial ammonia, synthetic ammonia.
This was 100 years ago. So
100 years ago, just about now, the first industrial process in the world started spewing about 25 tons of ammonia a day online.
And let's be clear about how important this has been and still is today.
Right. There are about 2 billion people alive today that would not be alive were it not for the synthetic ammonia that we built, that we make through the Haber process. Now, there's several interesting things about that. First of all, Haber came up with the idea in about 1909, and he put it in this pressure vessel, and it needed like 100 atmospheres of pressure, and he showed it to the German industry, and they said, great, fantastic. How much pressure does it work out? It's about 100 atmospheres. Well, our big industrial tanks blow at about eight or nine atmospheres. You can't. This just will not work. So another chap called Bosch, B-O-S-C-H, you probably got one of his washing machines, came along, and he is the man who actually turned that hypothetical process, as it were, or small scale process that Haber came along with, into the great machines that we see now. So suddenly ammonia starts pouring offline in 1913. The immediate impact was to lengthen the First World War by 2 years, because Germany would have run out of fertilizer to grow its own crops and would have run out of nitric acid, which it desperately needed for its armaments industry. And you can make ammonia into nitric acid relatively easy. So the first thing that happened there was it let Germany fight on a battle that it would have lost, a war it would have lost, by about 2 years. You can then argue that that war became increasingly bitter. The French then demanded such reparations that the Weimar Republic later collapsed, and we had the Second World War. A brief First World War might not have had the consequences. The second major...
You're a brave historian to sort of say that, though.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, I think it's a viable argument. The longer-term consequences that it added, as I say, 2 billion people to the world's population now, because we just could not sustain the 7 billion we've got now without the ammonium compounds that his process liberated.
This process, the Haber-Bosch process, is nicknamed bread from air, essentially, isn't
yes.
it? Yes. It's essentially you're getting nitrogen from the air and turning it into something useful. Nitrogen is something like 75% of the air.
Yes, it's like more than that.
78%. And the problem
is... 3% between friends.
Yes, exactly. What's the opposite?
So the problem is that nitrogen in the air, it's you find it's N2, nitrogen molecule, and nitrogen molecule... has 3 very strong bonds between the 2 nitrogen atoms in that N2 molecule. And that means it's not very reactive. So plants manage to sort of make use of bacteria to fix this nitrogen, turn it into useful compounds which they can use to help to build the plant. And then, of course, we get a lot of our amino acids, which also contain nitrogen, by eating these plants. But to fix it in the quantities that we need to make fertilizers was an extremely difficult procedure to figure out. And so in the end, the Haber process ended up using, you know, temperatures of nearly 500 degrees, pressures of up to 200 atmospheres now, maybe even higher, are used. And, you know, it's a huge industrial process. And it's not only fertilizers or explosives. We use ammonia to make synthetic polymers, nylon. We need ammonia to make nylon.
And bombs.
I said explosives just now.
I was going to say,
cleaning agents. Cleaning agents need it. Coolants in fridges. Yeah. We use it all over the place.
Yes. I mean, we're still utterly reliant on it. But the thing was, it was the transformation that happened 100 years ago is the really remarkable
so
thing.
So that's interesting. And as you said, the process ended up also being used to make explosives, which Haber, being a proud German, was probably okay with.
Yeah, he was very happy with that. He was a passionate German. He was of Jewish background, passionate German. And he, having done that, he then thought, well, what else can I do? How can I turn science to ensure a German victory? And he who actively promoted the use of gas as a weapon of war in the First World War. And at Ypres, I think 1916, and it was the thousands of tons of chlorine gas that were released onto Allied troops, British, French troops, was under his direction. And his wife was adamant. I mean, his wife was quite a gifted woman, and she begged him not to do this. And he went ahead and did it. And so she took his service revolver and shot herself a week after the release of this gas. So his life was always tainted with controversy. And when he got the 1918 Nobel Prize for his work on the Haber process, there was to say there was bad feeling is putting it very mildly. I mean, it caused very bad blood.
And of course, the thing was that you know, that was the First World War, and moving into the Second World War, he had quite a different role in the Second World War, which was, you know, for a man who was so patriotic in the First World War and threw all of his knowledge into trying to get Germany to win. Of course, Second World War, things turned out quite differently for him.
Yes, indeed, he became a major industrialist, but with the rise of Hitler comes in and doesn't want anybody of any Jewish association anywhere to do with science or industry, and Haber was kicked out. He came to Cambridge, didn't like the weather, and went to live in Switzerland, where he died, you know, a broken man. The irony is that the plants that he had developed at his industrial complex made a gas called Cylon B, which was used, of course, in concentration camps to kill millions of Jews.
How do you judge a man like that in history?
Well, it's a very good question. Yes. I think you have to judge him slightly harshly. I mean, he was so passionate about Germany that his native land, that it blinded him to sort of more general ethical issues. But that's very easy for me to say that now, because 100 years ago, everybody was more passionately national than they are today. We don't believe in it quite so much. So that's with 2020 hindsight. But he was also a genius, it has to be said.
Yeah. All right. Well, you can read Robin's story on theguardian.com. Now, before we wind up, Nicola, tell us what's happening in this month's Observer Tech Science Technology Science Monthly.
So yes, Observer Tech Monthly is out this Sunday. It's the 10th of November. And we have, it's absolutely packed with great features all about science and technology. So whichever floats your boat, we've got something for you. So we've got a fantastic feature all about Spotify and the founders of Spotify and how it's completely changed the music industry. And we also have a piece all about pandemics and the types of viruses that jump between species, so zoonotic diseases.
The SARS epidemic back in 2002...
Yep.
Was a horrible thing. It killed 800 people almost, infected more than 10 times that number, started in China, ended up in Canada very quickly. And it was one of those warning shots across the bows for what can happen if a new virus turns up that no one has immunity to. It can travel around the world very quickly.
And essentially the SARS virus, they've just confirmed, actually started in bats. And this is interesting because, of course, currently people are very much aware of the new MERS virus, which has started sort of last year and is still rumbling on now. And that so far has caused 144 cases and 62 deaths.
And they're both things for coronaviruses, which is this virus that type that lives in bats. And bats are, seem to be a platform for disease. I don't mean that in a bad way. They just are. They just have amazing immune systems, apparently. So that this paper that was published last week just confirmed that SARS did probably start from bats. It went through civets. It didn't go directly from bats to people. It went from bats to civets, these cats, and then from civets to people. And then that sort of circulation happens quite a lot. And it's kind of interesting that this sort of technology now is available for us to do these sorts of genetic analyses and stuff. 2002, it took them weeks to find out. Weeks and weeks to find out what the virus was, even longer to sort of sequence it, which seems weird, doesn't it? I mean, Robin, genetic sequencing has come on so much that to hear that something took weeks to sequence just sounds bonkers, doesn't it?
Yes, yeah, well, it took years for the human genome, and now it's days, it's hours, it's fantastic.
Yes. Robin, Nicola, thank you both very much indeed. And you can read Observer Tech Monthly on November the 10th, as I've just said. Also, all the news stories I've been talking about are at theguardian.com/science. According to a recent report by the UK's Office of National Statistics, one in every five people are affected by anxiety and depression. In recent years, the National Health Service has seen big increases in the use of medication to treat these conditions. Around £1 million a week is being spent on antidepressants. Now, bear those numbers in mind as you listen to Dr. Joanna Moncrief. She's a consultant psychiatrist and a lecturer at the Mental Health Sciences Unit at University College London. She says that the way we've been treating many psychiatric patients with mind-altering antipsychotic drugs is flawed. She wants doctors to get more sophisticated and for patients to be more informed about what these drugs are doing to them. She came into The Guardian to discuss her book, and I began by asking her to explain what a psychotic disorder is in medical terms.
We define a psychosis by the way that people appear and behave and what they say is happening to them. So when someone is having a psychotic episode, they seem to be having some very strange experiences that they sometimes think are real and coming from outside, but no one else can see that they're happening. So people might be hearing voices, hearing people speak to them when there's no one there, or when it doesn't appear that people are talking to them. They occasionally see things, that's less common. And they can develop some strange ideas and preoccupations, which we call delusions. So often people will develop paranoid delusions and think that people are out to get them or there's some plot against them. And sometimes they have grandiose delusions when they think they're the king or queen of England or think they're other great figures or have great powers or something like that. So the definition of psychosis is a state where it seems that someone has lost touch with reality, and it is defined by what people say and do and how they appear rather than by what's going on in the brain, because we don't know what's going on in the brain.
And so some of the terms people might have heard of in terms of the psychiatric psychotic diagnoses, what are they?
So some people who have psychotic episodes are said to have a condition called schizophrenia. And schizophrenia consists of these psychotic episodes that come on a recurrent basis. And also these people often have some other symptoms and difficulties such as lack of motivation and social withdrawal. So schizophrenia is is one pattern of psychotic episodes, but there are other people who have psychotic episodes, maybe just one or maybe a few, who don't seem to have these other difficulties.
Okay, and so you mentioned that we don't know what's going on in the brain, because I suppose to work out what's going on in the brain, you'd have to scan people or some other do some other invasive procedure to work this out. So in terms of how we've tried to treat these things in the last century or so, what's the sort of major paradigm?
Well, over the last half century, people have the main form of treatment has been drug treatment, and people have believed that what they're doing is rectifying some sort of underlying disease or an underlying chemical imbalance, as it's sometimes termed now. And part of what my work has been about is showing that we really haven't established that. We really don't have good evidence that this is what the drugs are doing, and that they could be doing something. They could be working in quite a different way. There has been a strong belief for a long period, longer than the last half century, that schizophrenia in particular is a brain disease that is caused by some sort of abnormality of the brain. And there's been research that is presented as showing that people with schizophrenia have slightly different sorts of brains than other people. But these differences are very subtle. There are lots of confounding factors, as I say in my book and other papers. Some of these differences at least are probably caused by drug treatment, and that's now becoming fairly well accepted.
Caused by drug treatment, as in they weren't there before?
Yes, it does now appear that there have been a number of studies all pointing in the same direction that show that if you take antipsychotic drugs, those are the drugs that are used to treat psychosis and schizophrenia, if you take them for long periods, people show a slight reduction in the volume of their brain and sometimes an expansion in the cavities of the brain. So basically the brain matter gets smaller, it shrinks. And that is associated with drug treatment. The more drug treatment you take for longer periods, the more likely you are to show those changes.
Do we know what's happening in those brains or why that's happening? What's in these drugs that's causing those structural changes?
We don't know that yet. People are looking at the way the brain looks, the different cells, what cells are affected in these in people whose brains are a bit reduced, and what cells aren't affected, but we don't know yet. No.
Okay, so going back to these antipsychotic drugs, there are lots of them around, everything from antidepressants to neuroleptics to lithium. What are the basic classes of these drugs, and what are they used for?
Well, the way drugs are now classified, and part of my work has been to show that maybe they're not classified in the right way, but the way that they're classified now is according to the disease they're thought to treat. So we have drugs that are called antipsychotics, which are principally designed and introduced to treat psychosis and schizophrenia, although they are also used in many other situations, and increasingly so. And then there are drugs like lithium and other drugs that have come to be recently known as mood stabilizers, which are thought to be specific for people with bipolar disorder or manic depression. And then there are antidepressants, which are thought to be specific for depression. So drugs are categorized now according to the disease that they're thought to treat. But what my work is showing is that actually We don't have the evidence that these drugs have specific effects on an underlying disease process, and it would be much better and more informative to classify drugs according to the sort of drug-induced effects that they produce.
So has the classification been traditionally because of, well, the way that it seems is that you have a particular set of symptoms and will treat those symptoms, or these drugs seem to help you with these symptoms, and so it doesn't necessarily treat the underlying cause of what's happening. Traditionally, various drugs have been used for various conditions, and if you present with a certain symptoms, then you get given that drug, never mind your particular brain activity.
The drugs are being given because they're believed to rectify whatever abnormal biological processes are thought or presumed to lead to symptoms. So they're not being given to cure the ultimate cause of the disorder, but it is thought that they act on some sort of physiological process that produce the symptoms or manifestations of particular disorders. What I'm saying is what's much more likely is that drugs, the drugs that we use in psychiatry, which we know affect anyone's feelings and behaviour. They're psychoactive substances. They act on the brain. Therefore, they change behaviour. They change feelings. They affect thought processes. What I'm saying is it's much more likely that the drugs are working because they induce these changes in behaviour and thoughts and feelings in everyone that they're given to, not just people who have these symptoms. But those changes might be useful in people with certain sets of symptoms or certain problems.
Let's think of an example of this, because I think that it would maybe make this come alive a bit. So if you have a particular condition, say for example, schizophrenia, and you're given a particular type of drug, in the traditional medical context, you're given this drug because that's what treats schizophrenia. It's an antipsychotic for that. But you're saying that there's an effect that this particular drug has on the brain, which it would have on anyone's brain, which may be helpful, may not be helpful. Just explain what might be happening with an antipsychotic that's used for schizophrenia.
Yes, absolutely. So the traditional way of thinking about antipsychotics in schizophrenia, or the way that's become dominant nowadays, is the idea that they are... they're rectifying some chemical imbalance which is producing the symptoms of psychosis. So what they're doing is they're normalising an underlying abnormality in the brain's biochemistry. Often that's said to be, for example, dopamine abnormalities. They're said to be normalising dopamine abnormalities. But people have come up with other theories that maybe the brain chemical serotonin and glutamate are also involved. And what I'm saying is that actually these drugs produce an altered state in anyone that you give them to. Anyone who takes an antipsychotic feels physically and mentally slowed and dampened down. And what I'm saying is that it's those alterations that the drug produces that dampen down the symptoms of psychosis, that dampen down delusions and hallucinations and agitated behaviour and preoccupations and emotional distress. It's not that they're rectifying some abnormality. It's the fact that they're dampening and slowing down mental and physical processes.
And they would do the same to anyone who doesn't have that condition as well. And so I suppose the question is, would patients want that if they knew that that's all that they were doing? I mean, maybe those effects are useful if you've got particularly psychotic episodes that and your brain has been dampened down. It's useful for you because then you feel slightly better, but not for everybody.
Absolutely. I mean, if you look at what patients say when they're taking these drugs, they're not very nice to take and most people don't like them. But some people who are really psychotic do find that dampening down effect useful and find that that is preferable to being in a psychotic state. Some people, on the other hand, don't, and they dislike that drug-induced state so much that they'd rather be psychotic. So people have different preferences. But there certainly are some people who find those dampening effects useful.
Now, when you say the word psychoactive, which is, you know, what these drugs are doing, people who may not be in psychiatry will immediately think alcohol, cannabis. These are all psychoactive substances. And I suppose there's a sort of label attached to that word, which is illegal drugs or recreational drugs. In what ways are these drugs we're talking about different to the drugs of alcohol and cannabis?
Well, what I'm saying is there's no fundamental difference. A psychoactive drug is a drug that works on the brain, and because it works on the brain, it changes the way people think, feel and behave.
Which you could apply to alcohol or cannabis.
And absolutely. And alcohol and cannabis and amphetamines and heroin all do this. And, of course, some of the drugs that we use in psychiatry, like the benzodiazepines, Valium and Librium, and amphetamines, which are used in children with hyperactivity, these are also recreational drugs. They're used by recreational drug users. So there's some overlap. Drugs like antidepressants and antipsychotics and lithium are psychoactive drugs in as much as they work on the brain and they modify feelings and behaviours. But the difference between them and the classical psychoactive drugs that are used recreationally, like alcohol and cannabis, are that most people don't like the effects of antipsychotics or antidepressants. In fact, if you give high dose antidepressants to volunteers, they make them feel a little bit edgy and they don't enjoy them. Yeah.
Yeah. But does it also mean that if you were to broaden out your definitions, as you said earlier, into psychoactive types, essentially, that would be more useful? We'll come into how that would be more useful in a moment. But does that mean that we can bring in other drugs which are psychoactive but have sort of fallen out of favour because of various political reasons, and LSD, these sorts of things? I mean, are they useful in some way for the conditions we want to treat?
Well, they might be. I'm not, I'm, I will stay neutral on the subject of LSD. I have an interest in the use of opiates because opiates are also drugs which cause this state of emotional indifference. And so it seems to me similar to the, I mean, they produce a different sort of emotional indifference to the drugs that we call antipsychotics, but they seem to sort of detach people from their distress in the same sort of way that antipsychotics do. And therefore, it seems to me that opiates might possibly be useful in people who are very psychotic, who are preoccupied and distressed by their psychotic experiences. And certainly opiates were used in the past in psychiatric institutions. Of course, there are lots of problems with opiates. They're not a panacea, and there are lots of problems with addiction and the fact that some people will find them rather appealing. But I think the point that you're making, which I would support, is that we shouldn't necessarily disregard psychoactive drugs because they are used recreationally. They might nevertheless have some quite useful effects in people who have the symptoms or behaviours of various things that we call mental disorders nowadays.
So in terms of the classifications that you would prefer then, so you prefer to classify the drugs that we use already and perhaps others into different ways they affect your mental state. And that, you said earlier, would be more useful for patients and doctors. So just explain that to me. What is it then, how is it then that someone with schizophrenia or other mental illnesses would be treated?
I think we need to approach the drugs much more directly. We need to see them as drugs, and we need to understand what sort of alterations they produce in people, physical and mental alterations, short-term and long-term. And then we need to try and work out what sort of situations those alterations might be useful in. So I suppose if you were treating someone with schizophrenia, this is obviously assuming that that person is able to take in this sort of information and make a judgment, and some people who are psychotic are not able to do that at the time that they're very psychotic. But assuming that they are, what you would be doing when you were offering someone drug treatment is saying, well, we have this substance and this substance and this substance available, and they produce this sort of effect or this sort of effect. Which do you think would be most useful? Maybe let's give that drug a trial and see if that helps you. You report back on how you are. Let's hear how your relatives think you are. Let's see how I think you are as a prescriber. And if that doesn't work, or if you don't like that, then let's try one of these other substances.
And the different drugs would therefore be used by different people for the same sorts of conditions.
Absolutely. I think different people would find different sorts of drug-induced states preferable to others, as does happen at the moment.
You mentioned also the conditions, the behavioural conditions that are being diagnosed increasingly in the past couple of decades, things like attention deficit hyperactivity disorder and attention deficit disorder. These are also being drugged as mental illnesses almost. Then there's a rise of depression as well. I mean, what's your feeling on the sort of on the treatment of these things? These aren't psychotic episodes, of course, but what's your treatment on there is a lot of drugs going on treating these sorts of conditions.
I think you first of all have to look at the evidence. So, and there are problems with the evidence, but nevertheless, it's important to see what we know about these different situations. So if you give an antipsychotic drug to someone who's acutely psychotic, it does seem that you can quite effectively suppress their psychotic symptoms. In someone with depression, if you give them an antidepressant, you change their depression rating scores a little bit, but it doesn't look as if those changes overall are really very clinically significant. And there are lots of reasons why people might change a bit more on the active drug compared to the placebo. So my reading of the evidence in depression, for example, is that actually antidepressants don't really have any clinically significant or useful effects in people with depression. In ADHD, it's a different situation again. It is certainly true that stimulants can improve attention and reduce hyperactivity in the short term, but the evidence about whether they have any beneficial long-term effects is much more ambiguous. Then you've got bipolar disorder or manic depression. Again, you can effectively treat a manic episode with sedative drugs like antipsychotics or lithium and other drugs that have sedative effects, some of which are now called mood stabilizers. But showing that you can have any long-term benefit is much more difficult. I think the evidence on that is not not definitive yet at all.
So this situation that we're in with drugs being used perhaps not correctly, people not understanding what the brain mechanisms are, and then this rise of behavioural behavioural drugs. How do we get to this situation? I mean, what's driven it? I mean, that's the big sort of $64 million question, really, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I think a number of factors have driven it. It's an interesting trend to look at and understand. Obviously, the pharmaceutical industry, who make profit out of selling more drugs, have been driving this trend in part. And they have been, for example, promoting the idea that bipolar disorder is more common than we previously thought, often goes unrecognised, and there should be more effort to diagnose and treat it.
And they couldn't have done it by themselves, though. They create the drugs, but someone has to use them.
Absolutely. And 20 years ago, they did the same with depression. They popularised, they funded campaigns that popularised the idea that depression was underdiagnosed, underrecognised and undertreated. But they, as you say, they couldn't do it on their own. They are supported by elements of the psychiatric profession that feel that the idea that they have effective drug treatments boosts their medical status, gives them higher levels of security, makes them look sort of high-tech and sophisticated and cutting-edge.
And it's good for patients if they feel like there's a pill that will solve their problems.
And finally, of course, there is public demand. It's very appealing to think that there's a nice, easy answer that out there for your emotional distress or your personal difficulties.
But so where do we go then with this? I mean, you've been talking about this for a long time, about what is happening in the brain. I mean, that seems to me the key issue here. And, you know, we've talked often about the 21st century being the century of the brain. We're going to find out more about everything from mood to consciousness to all sorts of things. And so that's all very exciting. But while we wait for that to come along, what do we do about these sorts of conditions? You said earlier that if you understand what a drug's doing to your brain, then you can then decide as a doctor and a patient how to use the best one for your condition. So that seems sensible. But at what stage do we start to work out what schizophrenia is in the brain or what depression is in the brain or these sorts of things, if they're not just simple chemical imbalances?
Well, in my opinion, we've been coming at this problem from the wrong angle. We've been treating depression and schizophrenia as if they might be something as relatively straightforward to unravel as a pneumonia.
I bet you a pneumonia scientist won't say that to you.
No, sure. But if you're looking at a physical illness, you've got the body to work on, and you've got various organs that you can investigate and various systems. To my mind, these are not simply physical disorders. They're not simply produced by physical abnormalities. Of course, everything that we do and say is, you know, we're embodied creatures. Of course, it is also manifested in our bodies and our brains. But I think that these are complex behaviours, which we're never going to... The mental disorders are complex sets of behaviours and emotions, and I don't think we're ever going to be able to pin them down to simple, discrete abnormalities in brain chemicals or abnormalities in brain structures. I suppose what I'm saying is every person with depression or schizophrenia is different. They've got there through a different route, and I don't believe that we're ever going to find a disease of schizophrenia that is present in everyone who has schizophrenia or present in everyone who has depression. There may be some complex physical factors that have fed into those disorders in various individuals, but I don't think that will be a single disease or even a set of diseases. I mean, I think most people would acknowledge that something like schizophrenia and depression too are heterogeneous, and there are a number of different pathways. But I don't think we're even going to be able to map out a number of diseases, of discrete abnormalities that we can then say, that's the origin of schizophrenia, that's the origin of depression, or of some cases.
And that obviously then puts a bomb on the idea that there's going to be a single drug or treatment that can solve all this. I mean, without worrying people, what's the sort of treatment path then? If there is such a diverse range of conditions, say schizophrenia, depression, whatever, which seems eminently sensible, then how do doctors and patients start to think about what they do about it?
Well, I think, psychiatry has always been about more than simply giving a pill or giving some sort of physical remedy or treatment. And it's always acknowledged the importance of looking at the whole person, at looking at their context, their history, their social circumstances, and trying to pull together a number of different sorts of interventions. The problem is that because of all this, partly because of all the sort of high-tech science that it's been possible to do recently, I think a lot of those social interventions and psychological interventions have been relegated in status, are not seen as being so important anymore. And I think that there are some quite basic interventions that can help people who are suffering from mental disorders, trying to identify ongoing stressors and do what is possible about them, trying to find some structured activity for people that's not too demanding, that doesn't tip them over into a psychosis, but allows them to function and have a role in society. Ways of helping people to maximise their independence and their ability to live on a day-to-day basis. None of these are very glamorous activities, and I think that's why they maybe haven't had the emphasis that they should have done. But I still think they're important and can make a difference to people's lives.
So it's much more about relationships and so it's just societal interaction rather than just chemicals.
Absolutely. Chemical modification can sometimes help people, but we need to see it for what it is. At the moment, at least, we do not have drugs, in my opinion, that are even treating the origins of symptoms, let alone the origins of diseases. What we're doing is we're chemically modifying people's behaviour. I think that's got a role, but we need to see it for what it is. It's not solving any problems. It's just putting a sticking plaster on them for a bit. And what we need to do is come in with social interventions that are going to help people with various mental health difficulties to survive and to have a role in modern society.
That was Dr. Joanna Moncrief. Her book, The Bitterest Pill, The Troubling Story of Antipsychotic Drugs, is out now in paperback. That's all we have for you this week. For breaking science news whenever you want it, just go to theguardian.com/science. And The Observer's Tech Monthly magazine is also in your papers this weekend. But from me, Alok Jha, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye. Thanks for listening.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today, no credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.